I'd like to welcome everybody to the Parsha class on Kisavo, 5766. We are just a week and a half away from Rosh Hashanah. And this Parsha is always read before Rosh Hashanah. And one of the features which we're not going to talk about is the klalos, the horrific admonitions which are given in the 28th chapter. And I refer you to those to read on your own. The Talmud says that the reason why we read this Parsha with those admonitions is so that all of the curses go out with the old year. And so that when we enter the new year, Rosh Hashanah, we look forward to a year of only blessing ahead. And may indeed this come to be this coming year. The opening section of Kisavo is the law of the Bikurim, of the offering of the first fruits, where each Jew who owns land in Israel and produces fruit, especially the seven species of Israel, wheat, barley, figs, dates, pomegranates, olives, and grapes, brings his, the very first fruits that ripened in a basket to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, and he makes a series of declarations. There's a very large emphasis placed on declaring and speaking. He can't just come and bring the fruits, but he has to say what he's doing. He has to come. In the beginning of the Parsha, it says in verse 3, "You shall come to whomever will be the Kohen in those days, and you shall say to him, I declare today to Hashem your God that I have come to the land that Hashem swore to our forefathers to give us." And that's only the first statement. "The Kohen shall take the basket from your hand and lay it before the altar of Hashem your God. Then you shall call out and say before Hashem your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. He descended to Egypt." And on, a short recounting of the history of the Egyptian exile. "Then we cried out to Hashem, the God of our forefathers, and he heard our voice, saw our affliction. He took us out of Egypt with a strong hand. He brought us to this place, and he gave us this land. And behold, now I have brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me, Hashem." You express your thanksgiving. You express your hakaras hatov, your gratitude. And it's a very, very moving ceremony. And it was so important that the Kohanim would take the time for every single Jewish landowner to go through this process. I'm sure each one took a good few minutes. I saw something in Rav Yerucham where he makes a big deal about this speaking. Now, I have to tell you a little bit of a story, just a very quick incident, that I had my sefer with me, the Rav Yerucham Lubavitcher sefer on Devarim, in my little bag. And I started my weekly readings earlier in the week, but I had planned yesterday, and particularly last night, to devote some time to reading further and to preparing my remarks for today. But I lost my bag with the sefer in it. I just found out about half an hour ago where it is, so I'm going to go pick it up later. But I did not have the sefer on Devarim with which to prepare the class. I'd only seen one or two paragraphs. So I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? I have to present the thoughts of Rav Yerucham to this class. So I said, well, let me think of something else which is relevant to the time, maybe in one of the other books. And I was thinking, this coming Motzei Shabbos, we will start the Slichos season. And in the Slichos, the recurring refrain is the words of Hashem to Moshe after the sin of the golden calf, the 13 attributes, where Hashem tells Moshe, this is what you should say before me to arouse my mercy, and I will forgive you. And we learn from the Talmud that this is a secret formula, that whenever the Jewish people are in need of mercy from God, we should recite these 13 attributes of mercy, and Hashem will never turn us away. And so that is the theme and the refrain of the Slichos, which we're going to be saying from this Motzei Shabbos all the way till the end of Yom Kippur. So I said, let's look back at the section dealing with the 13 attributes and see what Rabbi Yerucham has to say over there. It's primarily the ideas that he wrote over there which gave me some insight into the things I saw about Kisavo, and I'd like to try to put it all together kind of in my own way, but something which I think will give us something meaningful to go into this season with. We are going to be spending many, many hours praying. And I would like to really address the question, how do we properly connect with God through prayer? And it's an important question, and it needs a lot of attention. So here's what I gleaned, and it's going to be a little bit of a digression, but it will come back to the central question. When Hashem informs Moshe after many weeks of supplication, after the golden calf, where initially God had told Moshe that he was going to destroy the people, and Moshe supplicated for many, many weeks, when Moshe was first informed that Hashem would give them a second chance, and he would again give them the tablets of stone, which had been broken the first time, Hashem says to Moshe, I want you to come back up the mountain. And he gives him a very, very important instruction. Chapter 34, verse 3, in Shemos, not in Devarim. He says, I'm going to carve out the stones, and I will write on them like the first stones. He says, you come up to me in the morning onto Mount Sinai. Ve'ish lo ya'ale imach. But no man may ascend with you. You have to come up alone. Now Rashi on that says the following. A very revealing Rashi. Harishonos, the first tablets, al yidei shehayu b'tesuos v'kolos v'kihila, because they were given with that big gathering and with all the sounds. You know, all the Jewish people were standing at the foot of the mountain, and there was thundering and lightning, and it was a big hullabaloo. Sholta bohen ayin ra'ah. They were afflicted by an evil eye because it was so public. And Hashem says, we're not going to repeat that again. When I give you the tablets this time, it's just going to be you and me. It's going to be very quiet. And Rashi ends off with the words, Ein lecha yofa min hatznius. There is no greater measure or no greater quality than tznius, than quietness, than hidden, secret, still, as they say in Yiddish. Rav Yerucham connects with this a statement from the Talmud, which I was very, very pleasantly surprised to see, because I had just studied this passage of Talmud this week. And sometimes when you have that kind of a connection, there's like a real spark. And that's what I felt when I read this. There's a verse in the Song of Songs which says, Chamuke yirechayich. The roundness of your flanks are like jewels, the handiwork of a master craftsman. You know the Song of Songs is allegorical. You know that it's a love song. So the Talmud cuts right to the allegory and is referring to the words of Torah. And the words of Torah are compared to the flank. That's a kind of an archaic word, the thigh. Why are the words of Torah compared to the thigh? Lomar loch, this is Sukkah 49b. It is to inform you that just as the thigh is kept private, so too the words of the Torah must be studied in a private setting. And says the commentary to this, it is an element of the dignity due the Torah that its teachings should be studied discreetly. One should not sit at the high point of the city and study, since people pass by there constantly, nor should one teach his students in the marketplace. Even the first tablets And then he refers back to our story. Even the first tablets suffered from the pomp and circumstance surrounding them. There is nothing lovelier than modesty. On occasion, it is necessary to teach Torah in a public forum. That's acceptable. But in general, the modality for imparting words of Torah is very, very quiet and tznius, modestly. So Rav Yerucham takes off on this and says, why is it that Torah, which is so great, that it must be delivered and transmitted in quiet and in modest conditions? So here's what I understood from his words. The Torah is the wisdom of God. Where is God? Where can we find God in the world? I ask him. Where can we find God? Any answers? Yes.
In nature. And in living beings.
But God makes the day and night. There is day and night.
So every time I look at nature, I see God. And every time, God's manifestation, and every time the guy next to me looks at nature, does he see God?
Well, God is not seeable.
Okay.
God is hidden.
So where is he? Where is he hidden? He's hidden in our hearts. He's hidden in our perception. In other words, you only see God in nature because you see God in nature, which means that that realization is really inside of you. It's in your heart and in your perception.
To me, that is too, forgive me for saying it, it's too superficial. But there's a much more profound thing, and that's the creative force that keeps the world functioning. And that's the great mystery, and that's Hashem.
But that's only to you, because you recognize it. What I'm trying to do is say that's not the superficial, that's really the depth. The depth is that God is to be found only in the hearts of those who recognize him.
So he doesn't exist for some, and does for others.
Isn't it true?
But God is more than that.
But it's only perceptible in the hidden recesses of the heart of he who believes in it. Now, of course, to he who believes in it, malo chol haaretz kevodo, the world is filled with his glory. But the point is, it's only in the eye of the beholder. Where is God's wisdom to be found? Wisdom as expressed in the Torah. Okay, God is found in nature, but is also found. He has a vast ocean. Oceans upon oceans of wisdom. And that was contained within the Ten Commandments and then in the Torah and the written Torah and the oral Torah. Where is that to be found?
I think you can see God's wisdom in specific in Torah, because the Torah is the blueprint of the universe. But we can see God's wisdom in every, as we're saying, in everything, such as, you know, look at the universe, look at the order of the stars, the cells, how they function, all of that, even if in the person's body that doesn't recognize it as a god, he has godly forces in him, or he'd be thin, he'd be dead. The fact that, in my opinion, the fact that even an inanimate object doesn't have what we call life, like a rock. There is power, there's mineral, there's this chemistry, there's elements, molecules, there's stuff in there that if it wasn't because God wanted to exist, it wouldn't even be existing. That's what I think. So, like, the first thing, like, seeing God in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only, unfortunately, that the soul of the person that doesn't see God is not willing to, or not able to, or hasn't learned to recognize. But he is still even Telem Elokim in some level.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a level of godliness. But, of course, I think the highest level, as Jews that know Torahs, is to be found in the Torah, because it's one thing to see the artist's creation, but it's another thing to talk to the artist.
Right. Okay. So God is contained within the Torah. Where is the Torah found? Is it in the bookshelf?
In the Aron Kodesh.
Is it in the Aron Kodesh?
Yes.
So if a person opens up the Aron Kodesh and he looks at that Torah, he automatically perceives God's wisdom because he's looking at the scroll. Where is the Torah found?
according to what you say, it's only the person who believes it who looks at that Torah.
It's only found inside the mind and the heart of he who studies it. Which I think that's why when the Talmud says that the words of the Torah are beautiful when they are kept private, it refers to those who teach the Torah should not sit in public, because we're not talking about putting the scroll. I mean, the scrolls should also be housed in a private setting. They shouldn't be displayed. They should be behind a curtain. But what's more important is that the one who possesses the knowledge of Torah is actually the housing, the casing of the Torah, and that person should behave modestly. What I'm getting at is that God in this world, this is a hidden world, right? This is not the world to come where God is revealed. This is the world in which God is hidden, and we've spoken about that many times. Where is he hidden? He's hidden in the hearts and the minds of people, which is the most quiet and the most modest place there could ever be. It's totally invisible, totally hidden, submerged within a person's innermost feelings and thoughts. Hira.
I think, though, there's no contradiction in what you're saying, that the average person doesn't think about God in what he has done or what he has created. They think about it at a different level, the average person. It's only those that have become more educated think about God in what he has accomplished and what he has done in his world. Other than that, the average person, I believe, thinks about God as somebody he's praying to for wanting or thanking. But that's it. Mm-hmm. Until they become educated about what has been done,
mm-hmm.
they say their prayers, but they don't know the glory of what has been created in the world. That's just my opinion.
Well taken. I'm trying to reach the point where we actually solve this problem of how do we communicate with God, and I think the answer is going to be shocking. Okay, but we're trying to get to that point.
Are you provoking us?
Very good.
So to review, so far we have discovered that God, the wisdom of the Torah, is hidden, and it is hidden inside the hearts and the minds of the people that will perceive him, as far as this world is concerned. God does not reveal himself any more than that. He reveals himself through our own perception. This could be the meaning behind the verse, the phrase, which is said oftentimes. It's part of Psalms 92, I believe it is. Yoshev b'seser elyon. The exalted one sits in secret. Yoshev b'seser elyon. And that was established really just in time for the second tablets. The first time he revealed the Torah, he did it in a more public way. He revealed himself in a more public way. It was said that all nations of the world heard the sounds and the commotion surrounding the giving of the Torah the first time, but nobody heard it the second time. It was only Hashem's communication with Moshe, and from then on it would be the private communication between Moshe and his students. So Hashem was establishing a new protocol. The Rav Yerucham says a very, very poignant phrase. Ki im Elokim eincha eladavka kisha'ata behatznea ubeseser. You will not be with God except when you are modest and in private. What I think he's saying is that in order for a person to connect with God, it can only be done in the recesses of his private, intimate thoughts and reflections inside of himself. A person can go to a public place like a shul and that could inspire him. But remember, God is not out there. God is in intimacy with myself. We have to become introspective, reflective, in order to find God. We have to look inside. Now, there's one missing piece, because how do I access that inner place? So you're telling me that God is in my heart, but where do I begin? Where is the I? You told me where the He is, but where is the I? So here is where speech comes in. Intimate connection with God begins when we start to speak intimately with Him. But I think that there is a piece missing before that. Because if the dialogue takes place within myself, and I'm going to be speaking with God within my own intimate recesses of my heart, I ought to be able to do one more thing before I do that. What do you think that is? It's going to sound a little foolish.
Talk to yourself.
You got to talk to yourself. How often do we talk to ourselves? But I don't mean think to ourselves. I mean talk to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We do?
Quite often, I think so.
Do we talk to ourselves? How many people here talk to themselves? Don't be ashamed. We will not let it get past this room.
I'm thinking all the time, but I'm not talking to myself.
Right.
Well, it doesn't have to be out loud.
No, I'm talking about out loud. I'm not talking about thinking. We all think. We all have myriad of thoughts. You know, most of those thoughts are not even voluntary. We do lots of thinking, but most of them are just thoughts that came into our mind. How many times did we decide that we want to tell ourselves something and actually opened our mouths and said what we decided to say? We talk a lot more to other people than we do to ourselves. There's a problem there. Because if we don't talk to ourselves, we're not really in touch with ourselves. How can we talk then to someone else if we don't talk to ourselves? Much less, how can we talk to God if we don't talk to ourselves? When after all, that's where God is found, inside of me. So there has got to be a process of learning whereby we talk to ourselves. Now I'm going to tell you what Rav Yerucham says on the verse right before God reveals the 13 attributes. We're going to be saying these words again and again. Vayered Hashem be'anan, vayisyatze v'imosham, vayikra v'shem Hashem. This is Pasuk 5, 34:5 in Shemos. Hashem descended in a cloud and stood with him there, and he called out with the name Hashem. Who called out with the name Hashem? Well, in the art scroll, they have the H of He capitalized, which means Hashem called out with his own name. And then he proclaimed the 13 attributes to Moshe. The first thing he did when he approached Moshe was he said out loud his own name. Hashem said his own name before Moshe. Says Rav Yerucham, what was that all about? Hashem, just like Hashem was speaking to himself, with himself and to himself, he was teaching Moshe that a man always needs to speak with himself and to himself. Hashem was teaching Moshe that if you want to have an intimate connection with me, you have to learn how to talk to yourself. I'm sorry to say, but if you can't do this, you can't pray. This is the shocking part. If you can't talk to yourself, you can't possibly be talking to Hashem. You can make noise. You can do like external things. You can get out, just like a shul is a place with a lot of external noise, but that's not where Hashem is found. That's kind of like the advertisement. You know, here is where people talk to God, and this is the singing and the outward. That is the outward trappings, the icing, so to speak. But the real communication with God happens in intimate dialogue with Him, which can only be done when a person knows how to be intimate with his own thoughts, which is to speak to oneself. And it doesn't mean passive, it means active. That means talking. So I don't know, after reading this, I feel like I haven't even begun to pray. Seriously. I remember Rabbi Feldman once giving a sermon on this topic. He said that we don't like to be alone with ourselves. That's why when we get into the car, the first thing we do, turn on the radio, turn on the music. Then we can turn off our own communion, personal communion. It's a perfect time. Used to be that we didn't even have to take phone calls. Now we can take phone calls in the car. But he says, this is a time to be alone with yourself and to dialogue. And without that, we cannot really pray. So to summarize, and then we'll move back to Bikurim. In order to connect with God through tefillah, and in general, we need to become accustomed to talk to the transmitter of that connection, which is ourselves. We have to talk to ourselves before we can talk to God, who is really within ourselves. This is going to require actual verbal expression. Now, coming back to Bikurim, what is so important about, why is there an emphasis on speech? Because we're talking about gratitude. Probably one of the most intimate feelings that a person can have is the feelings of expressing, first admission. Expressing gratitude assumes that I feel grateful. I cannot feel grateful until I admit that I was recipient of benefit that someone other than myself provided me. That is a very difficult step for many people, to admit my dependence. There's a powerful, powerful transformation going on in this mitzvah of Bikurim. I, who worked hard for my own produce, I toiled. I'm the one who labored. I have to stop, and I'm not allowed to eat that fruit. I have to take it before God, and I have to say, wait a minute, where did this come from? How did I even land up here in this land with a bounty? Because you, God, took me from nothing. I had nothing. I was a slave. My ancestors were slaves. I had absolutely nothing. It was only on your graces. There's a tremendous admission of dependence going on. On top of that, it's not enough for me just to do the action of giving the fruits. I have to sit there and I have to verbally say it. That's like, you know how some people can't say thank you? This is like a super thank you. They have to admit and verbally express their deepest, most deep sense of dependence for everything they have. And it's not in public. It's only in front of one Kohen and really before Hashem. The mitzvah of Bikurim is forcing us, obligating us, and literally forcing us to express with words our innermost feelings and our most intimate expressions, our dependence, our gratitude, our thanks for everything that we have. And that's very much tied together with what we're talking about. That the experience of prayer, connection with God, starts with the ability to literally think within myself, decide what it is that I must express, and do so with intent, with deliberation, and to say those words. Here we're fortunate because the words are given to us. And we're also fortunate that we have a prayer book with all the prayers, but there's a danger there. The danger is that we can just end up reading and we're really not communicating. So what we have to take out of here is that the Torah is telling us it's very, very important to learn how to do this. It's important to learn how to talk. It's important to learn how to talk what's deepest inside of us, to express it even to ourselves. And only through there will we be able to carry on a meaningful and a real communication and dialogue with Hashem. A lot of this is new for me. I have to digest this myself, but I think that there's something very, 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 very fundamental here that lies at the core of really everything that we do, and particularly the prayers and the hours and hours which we are looking forward, or hopefully we're looking forward to be doing. We'll be doing it whether we like it or not. It behooves us to give some serious thought to these ideas about communicating, talking, and expressing ourselves to Hashem. We wish everybody good luck. I look forward to trying to do this myself more, and I hope that everyone finds themselves having more meaningful prayer.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
To be a Jew is to be thankful to God.
Yes.
And as you've just pointed out, the way to do that is to dialogue about it through thanking Him, through speaking to yourself, and so on. But isn't there an even more profound element, and that is incorporated in the word knowing, K-N-O-W, knowing. Just as in human relations, you can only have a good, meaningful relationship with another person if you know them.
Mm-hmm.
You know their wants, their weaknesses, their strengths, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Interact that way. So too with Hashem. If you, quote, know Hashem, and I guess the way to do that is through study and learning. Isn't that an important element in all?
Yes. I mean, as we spoke about, knowledge of the Torah is what, like Ron said, that the most effective way of knowing God is through the Torah. I mean, you can get certain sense of it by observing His works, His nature, and so forth, but much more by studying the words of His Torah and the ideas. So yes, definitely. But even that, it's interesting that in order for that to be effective, in order for that to really sink in, the sages teach us, not in Pirkei Avos, but a verse is quoted there, that you have to say the words. Here it is. Ki chayim heim lamotz ehem. For they, the teachings of the Torah, are life to those who find them. This is quoted in Pirkei Avos, the 6th chapter, the 7th Mishnah. The Talmud expounds on the word motz ehem, those who found them, and homiletically read it as, which is very typical of Midrashic teachings, lamotzi ehem, the peh. It is life to those who express them verbally. So the knowledge of the Torah is actually accessed through the verbalization of its words. And that has a lot to do with knowledge. I remember one of our Rebbeim from the yeshiva was a master not only at understanding the Torah, but explaining it. He was probably the greatest explainer of Torah concepts that we had. And he used to say to the students, if you can't explain what you learn to someone else, then you haven't properly understood it. So we're not coming to exclude knowledge. We're saying that the power of speech is actually that tool which makes the knowledge come to full realization. It is the instrument of knowledge. And it is ultimately the instrument of communication with God as well. Okay, Fran.
2 points come to mind on the Jewish person and the Shechina and the Minyan. I think it's a very interesting thing that we... it's interesting having this conversation in this class today because my little Yehuda, 6-year-old, is asked me the other day, and then his little brother, the 3.5-year-old, David, asked me about where is God. I want to see God. I want to see Hashem. They say Hashem. So I want to see Hashem. And so I gave him the explanation. Well, you know, you can see it in everything that you look, and you have behavior, and you learn Torah, and you know, I try to like. And they wanted like a more physical, but I satisfied them on some level. But it occurs to me that we have the concept of Shechina, where if a person is in a minyan, then we are told that we bring the Shechina to us. So therefore, our davening, even though it appears to be in a public setting, we're really, as you talked about today, so beautiful with Robert Yosef's commentaries, and, you know, it's really what we have going on in our own self, the communication with Hashem through ourselves, that yet there is the presence that we bring down altogether, you know, the power, the more power of Hashem. There's more, I think that's one of the only ways I'm aware of to access more of Hashem, besides, you know, take something beautiful that He created standing on a beautiful mountain or next to the Kotel or somewhere, you know. Imagine, like, the most holy place you could stand in the world, I think, is right at that wall in the tunnel next to, you know, as close to the Kodesh Kodeshim as you could get to, I think. But that ability to access the Shekhinah, I think that would be the closest that we can actually physically, whatever physical means, you know, spiritually come to the contact with the Shekhinah. So my point is that even though we're accessing Hashem ourselves and talking to Hashem inwardly, we have to not forget the outward, that all of us are focused together. So
right.
There is an outward presentation.
See what I'm thinking about that as well. How come it is, if prayer is so intimate, why do we have to have a minyan?
Uh-huh.
And why do we say Barov Am Hadras Melech? With the more people there are, the more glory it is for the king.
Uh-huh.
It kind of seems contradictory. I think you're pointing that out. But think of it this way. If the act of prayer means being very intimate with your own thoughts and your own communication with Hashem, and you're doing that, and the person next to you is doing that, and the person, you know, next to him is doing that, you have 10 people being intimate in their own thoughts with God at the same time, in the same place. It's not the fact that we're losing our intimate connection.
Okay.
It's just that we're all engaging in this intimate connection together at the same time.
Right.
But as we stand to daven, we're not thinking, my davening is not about the next guy. In fact, the halacha states that you should hear, it's very good. It fits in with what we're saying very much. You're supposed to say the Shmona Esrei loud enough that you can hear yourself talk, which is interesting. You can't just eye the words. And you're not even ideally just supposed to say the words, moving your lips but not making any sound. You're supposed to produce a sound so that you can hear it, but so that the person next to you can't hear it. So it's exactly this point. Because prayer is really an intimate experience. And you should not, that's different. I'll tell you, that's a very good question. Let me get to that in a moment. Very good question. The act of prayer, which is in the Shmona Esrei primarily, is an intimate act, and you're not supposed to be thinking about other people. But the fact that so many people are doing it at the same time, that's where the Shekhinah comes down. And the whole thing about external stimulus, like being in a certain place, you know what that's for? That's only to inspire you so that you can be more intimate. But it's not about leaving the intimacy and going and trying to concretize and make it physical, because the connection with God is not a physical thing. It's only now since we are physical people, we are sometimes stimulated by physical things. But it's only a key to be able to be more intimate. Now, Jeffrey raises a good point. How come we have certain things? You can only say Kaddish when you have a minyan, and you only say Kedusha with a minyan, and that's something which we proclaim out loud. Very good point. There's a difference between prayer, which is Shmona Esrei, which is always quiet, and public declarations, like Kaddish and Baruch Hu and Modim. That's something else. That's not really prayer. Those are called Dvarim Shebekdusha. Those are things, phrases, the statements of holiness, and that has its purpose too. There's something that inspires people to have that intimacy, but those responses, the Kaddish and the Kedusha, are done out loud, but that's not really prayer. Prayer is the quiet. Prayer is the Shmona Esrei. It's other things. Tefillah is really just the Shmona Esrei. I'm not saying it's not holy. I'm saying it's not prayer. It's not intimate dialogue with Hashem. A lot of things that we do are out loud, but the real close connection is something that's quiet, intimate. Yeah.
In order to answer also my son's questions, we look into the Torah, and Hashem gives us examples that we can understand. Of course, He says literally, "I took you out with an outstretched arm, and you know, and out of Egypt, and you know, I carried you out," and you know, ideas like that, which you know, I guess. If one were to take it literally, you could imagine Hashem being, in a physical way, you could imagine being, you know, gigantic, you know, the size of, you know, huge mountains, you know, if you were to imagine taking it literally. So I wanted to ask you, how is a good way to give a child an understanding where, on one hand, you could say Hashem kind of looks like us, but He's so big and so strong. This is another thing I told the children, that if you were to try to look at Hashem, we couldn't live. You know,
yeah.
He's so strong. But yet, we're given these words in the Torah. Actually, literally, we could say, you know, Hashem is gigantic, invisible, and yet, if you were to see Him, you could imagine how you know, he could pick up an Yisrael with his hand and move motion, you know, and take us out of Mitzrayim, and you know, so therefore, in that way, there's a physical, you know, at an early level, try to picture something that you're trying to pray to when you're six or three, you know.
See, you're raising really a good point. Because, listen, don't we celebrate Shavuos? Don't we celebrate the giving of the Torah with the thunder and the lightning? And yet, Rashi tells us that experience failed. So why are we celebrating it? We shouldn't be celebrating Shavuos. We should be celebrating the giving of the Torah to Moshe quietly. We shouldn't even celebrate Shavuos. Shavuos was bad. What?
And you couldn't celebrate
that because it would be too quiet. So, but that raises another question. So why did God do it that way? If Tznius is the way, if Torah is accessed through quiet and privacy, why did God do it the first way? It must be that we failed. We failed to take the public, just like we said before, when you're in the shul, it's public. But the purpose of that is to be inspired to make the intimacy greater. Apparently, we failed to make that connection. We took the public and we didn't bring it inside. And it just became a big party. It'd be like going to shul and all you think about is the guy next to you. And you never take it to heart. So, the same thing with the Torah. We would have seen the miracle of Har Sinai and that should have gone deep, deep into the hearts of each individual and made us pure, and it didn't do that. So there's always a double-edged sword, right? We need to have this outer external stimulus to move us because we're physical people, but we have to make the transition into the privacy. So therefore, the child needs the stories. The child needs to celebrate Pesach. Everyone needs to celebrate the miracles, the 10 plagues. We need that. But somehow we have to also figure out a way to transform that inward to the child. So maybe we have to also speak about things like when a child does something like a mitzvah or shows a good midah, then you praise the child and you say, You just performed an act of kindness. That's how Hashem acts. You just did a mitzvah. Let's say you visited the sick. You know, Hashem visited Abraham when he was sick. So you have similarities. You have some of the midos of Hashem. Teach a child that Hashem is also inside of him.
We're bringing more kedusha into the home. We say to them, "You brought more of Hashem's the holiness of
Hashem
in our home."
Very good.
But I tell
right.
you, it's
very
a
good.
Concept of telling them, at least they have a visual image since we're physical.
Yeah.
Of this, of our Hashem being so amazing that
right.
he couldn't even imagine. I mean, there's nothing to compare it to. You know,
right.
Hashem is huge.
Right.
You know, and looks like
right.
Rabbi Rosenbaum, kind of like, you know,
right.
I mean, just a picture
right.
in their mind. Again, this is a physical thing.
Right.
And, you know, you have your image of how, you know, when you think of Hashem, sometimes I think of Hashem more in terms of just the amazing, in order for me to self-focus into it, think of Hashem as the most amazing thing that could mold, you know, the power to move the stars and the planets
mm-hmm.
and to all-knowing it everywhere all
mm-hmm.
at the same time, you know. So it, that's hard to explain to a child, but
mm-hmm.
there is a concept that Hashem must be an amazingly
right.
huge in some way.
You know, it reminds me when we first opened up the Air and Space Museum. I'm from the Washington suburb, and in 1976, for the big celebration of the bicentennial birthday, they opened up this new museum. So one of the things that it had, it might still be there. It's like not a major film, but it's a little side thing. They have this fellow lying on sleeping on a blanket in a park in Florida. So they have the guy sleeping there, and his arm, his hand is up on his chest like this. So the camera is focusing on this man, and all of a sudden the camera backs up further and further. Soon you see the whole park. Have you ever seen this little film?
Go.
Soon you see the whole park, and then it goes up, and then you see the neighborhood, and then you see
mm-hmm.
the city, and then you see, pretty soon you're looking at the shape of Florida, and then you're going out into space, and then you see the globe, and then you see, you know, then you don't see it anymore, you just see the stars, everything. And then the camera eventually stops. and then it starts zooming back again, smaller, and then it goes all the way back to the guy lying on the blanket, and then it goes in, and it goes into his hand, and you see the skin, and then it goes into that, and you see the cells, and then you see the, and then it gets to the point where you're at the atom. So that's like Hashem. He's huge, and he's tiny. He's way, way, way above us, and he's way, way, way in us, because we have the neshama. So we have to somehow impress ourselves and on the child the grandeur of God, at the same time the tremendous intimacy, because of our accessible in the recess of our own hearts and minds to connect with God. But that the thing of prayer, which we do all the time, is primarily an internal thing, not an external thing. Mm-hmm. It's not about a bunch of people moving and shuckling and the vision of the talasim. That's losing, getting distracted and not focusing on what's really happening.
Mm-hmm. So you can almost see where the goyim went wrong in their understanding. They have a mythology about a man, and they eventually call him a god or a son of God or a whole concept, because they look at, as we're talking about, inside God is in us. Mm-hmm. God is, and so they're so removed, like the pagans or the Romans were so removed from everything, they're the opposite of holiness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So eventually when they saw something holy, when they, you know, in their whole mythology, they elevated it and they brought it, and then that is the godliness for them.
Yeah, that's what Yerucham says, that the main sin of the golden calf was that they were exposed to this revelation of God, and they, because of their physical nature, they needed something to focus on. When Moshe was gone, they needed something else. So they were well-meaning, but they got stuck on the object.
Right.
And when you get stuck on the object, then that becomes idol worship.
Shukoyach.